Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks Sunday, December 9th, 2018. This is episode 1548. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Brex, the first corporate credit card for startups. Get the card free, and TWiT listeners get Brex card fees waived in perpetuity at brex.com/TWiT. And by LastPass, secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 43,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/TWiT. And by CuriosityStream, a subscription streaming service that offers over 2,000 documentaries and nonfiction titles from some of the world's best filmmakers, including exclusive originals. Visit CuriosityStream.com/TWiT and use the code TWIT to get 1 month free. Well, hey, how are you today? Good to see you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Yeah, it's that time. The geek with his own radio show. Sorry about that. But, you know, we're talking about interesting things. Computers, the internet, home theater. We talk about digital photography. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, coming up later on in the show. We talk about smartphones, smart watches. Yes, they exist. Augmented reality, virtual reality, self-driving cars, anything, I guess anything with a chip in it, anything digital. Does that make sense? 888-ASK-LEO, that's my phone number if you want to call and talk about it. 888-827-5536, toll free in the U.S. and Canada. You can still reach it outside those countries, and we do have listeners all over the world, thanks to the amazing internet. Just use Skype or something, and Skype out, it'll be free. 888-ASK-LEO. Website, techguylabs.com. I put inside the website all of my insight. Well, I don't do it. But our good friend James DeRuvo is writing this down. We even at the website, we put audio and video of the shows after the fact. And it's kind of a good repository. It's got a good search engine for all the things we talk about day after day for 1,548 shows since 2004. We're almost on our what is it, 215th anniversary in about a month. The 15th anniversary of the Tech Guy Show. What? Hey, I want to congratulate Rich DeMuro. Rich on Tech, you know, he's on KTLA Morning News in LA, and he's my regular fill-in host. It says here on the back of his new book, fill-in host for a nationally syndicated technology radio show. Thanks for the plug, Rich. His new book is 101 Handy Tech Tips for the iPhone. It's thick. I don't know if this is Rich's first, but nicely done. Lots of illustrations. Lots of explanations. If you're getting a new iPhone, Rich DeMuro, 101 Handy Tech Tips for the iPhone. It's funny because my first book was 101 Computer Answers You Need to Know. And that was... Man, when did that come out? I want to say 94. So that was some, I can't even do the math. Many moons ago, almost 25 years ago. And he's about 25 years younger than me, so I guess it's appropriate. 101 Handy Tech Tips for the iPhone. Good going, Rich DeMuro. Congratulations. It's funny because his book about the iPhone comes at a time of smartphone decline. This is a really good article from New York Magazine. They do good tech coverage from their Intelligencer blog. We're no longer in smartphone plateau. We're in smartphone decline. Jake Swearingen wrote it. I wonder what you think about this. I think this is pretty obvious to me. He says from roughly 2007 to 2013, 2007, of course, when the iPhone was first introduced, to about 5 years ago, the smartphone grew at an astonishing pace, double-digit growth year after year, even through a recession. And, of course, every smartphone was a massive improvement on its predecessor. It reminds me a little bit of the early days of the PC, the personal computer. We got 20 years of just constant innovation, improvement, and speed improvements. But just as the personal computer kind of hit a plateau where it wasn't getting much faster, that's been going on for, what, 5 years, 6 years, 8 years. It's not been getting much faster. And operating systems haven't gotten much different. Smartphones are getting that way too. In fact, the idea of a smartphone plateau is nothing new. Sales have been tapering off for a while. They actually, according to IDC, declined for the first time ever in 2017. That was globally, year over year. And in 2018, the year we're just completing, I say, for reference to those of you not sure, the U.S. market for the first time declined. IDC, which is an international data corporation, their market analysts say, we're at a market saturation rates of 90 to 100% in many developed markets. In other words, everyone who's got a smartphone, who wants a smartphone, who's going to buy a smartphone, has a smartphone. And the interesting point that Jake Swearingen makes in this article is that phones really now are kind of more like cars in the sense that we don't replace it, or we shouldn't replace it. We should repair it, because the next phone that we buy at a healthy $1,000 won't be really significantly better at all, any more than a new car is going to be significantly better than your old car. The improvement is kind of, very gradual at this point. The phone companies, especially Apple, are making their phones more expensive in an effort to make up for the dropping sales volume by increasing price so that their revenues continue to go up. That's exactly what Apple did. It made more money per phone, so it didn't matter that fewer people bought phones. But they didn't, and they're trying desperately to figure out something new. Look at Samsung with its foldable phone. Isn't that a silly thing? It doesn't seem to me that it solves any problem anybody's presenting. This phone is great. If only it were thicker and foldable, I'd be really happy. Samsung's new phone, which should be out in early next year, has three screens. One on the front that looks like a regular phone, and then you open it up and it's got doubles up and you have a bigger screen, and that's going to cost, I'm sure, $1,200, $1,500. Some people even think maybe $2,000. What's interesting, of course, is that all of the technologies in the high-end $1,000 phones has trickled down now, and you can get a $300, $400 phone, a OnePlus 6T, for instance, or last year's phone. Jake points out the last year's phone being awfully close to this year's phone is probably a good buy, and often hundreds of dollars less. He says in cars, few people buy new cars. Doesn't make sense financially. The secondhand market for phones isn't taking off, but people are buying last year's model. You can get a Google Pixel 2, for instance, for $649, $150 than a Google Pixel 3. And is there a big difference? Probably not. The iPhone XR, which I love and I think is probably the iPhone people should buy instead of buying an older one, get this year's model, but for $750 instead of what is the XS? The least expensive XS sell for? About $150 more, right? $900. You want an iPhone 8? Hey, it's only $600. And this is where the right to repair becomes very important. We're probably going to keep them longer and fix them instead of throwing them out. And that's a good thing in a lot of ways, for landfill, for your own wallet. It's a different world now for smartphone manufacturers. They can't count on people like me. I'm sitting in front of three late model iPhones. But I'm like a car reporter who talks about cars, right? You get more than one. I got an iPhone XS Max right here. I got a Pixel 3 XL right here. I got a Samsung Galaxy Note 9 here. And that's just a small sampling of my collection. I don't want all these phones, but I guess I have to review them. I do have to say, though, when I travel, I do carry two. I carry the iPhone and the Pixel, an Android phone and an iPhone. I don't know why. The Pixel 3 blows me away with the quality of the camera. I think that's probably why I carry that one. Just an amazing, amazing camera. Anyway, what do you think? Is it the end of the line for major phone innovation, just as it became the end of the line for computer innovation? And then I guess what happens is companies are looking, well, how are we going to make more money? Oh, I know, we'll make a watch. A watch that only works if you buy the phone. Oh, that's a good idea. What if we put a
What if we made a car that drove itself?
Well, that's a good idea, yeah.
How about helicopters that drive themselves?
Okay. I always wanted a flying car.
How about we've got something you put on your head that makes you feel like you're in the real world?
Hmm. You mean like a hoodie?
No. This will be much more expensive, like virtual reality.
Oh, yeah, that'll be good. 8888-ASK-LEAH. That's my phone number. I want to talk high-tech with you. 888-827-5536. Call the tech guy. That's me. Kim Schaffer will answer. We'll get you ready. We'll straighten your tie, comb your hair, get that cowlick flattened out, and you'll be making your appearance on a nationally syndicated radio show soon. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the mighty, mighty Kim Schaffer.
It must be my Sunday song. He gives me different songs on Saturdays, but this
that's
my
interesting.
Sunday song.
Well, you should have. Everyone should have a Sunday.
I'm
best.
Just waiting for him to play "Baby, It's Cold Outside."
It is chilly, but you have to sit in a highly air conditioned.
Highly,
room.
Yes, I have a very thick jacket.
Yeah.
Here.
Well, it's please don't freeze on my account.
No.
Hello,
it's
Kim.
Not too bad right now, actually.
You have been answering the phones over a hot phone. Well, not hot enough, apparently.
Hot steaming phone.
Slaving over a steaming phone.
Yeah.
To bring us some fine questions.
Fine indeed. We got Terry in Amarillo, has a brand new MacBook Pro, a little bit jealous, but he wants to know what email program to put on that. Which one is the best?
Yeah. One of my favorite topics.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Or is it your favorite topic of the moment?
Well, I love talking about I'll explain in a moment. Thank you, Kim. Thank you. And let's say hello to Terry in Amarillo, Texas. Hello, Terry.
Hi, Leo. How's it going?
I'm going well. I think for you as well. You got a brand new toy.
I did. And having fun setting it up. It's taking a while because I didn't want to just transfer everything from the MacBook Air. So putting fresh downloads of everything on it.
That's a good idea. It's probably not necessary on the Mac or iPhone, but it sure feels better, right? Nice and clean. The real advantage of doing that is you can take some time to not reinstall the things that you were installed previously and only install the stuff you know you want. Because what happens over time with any computer is you get, that looks cool, and you install that and install that, and pretty soon you got 100 things on there that you never use. And it's important to remember this adage. Every single program you put on your computer is a potential security risk, not because it's malware, but because the author may have made a mistake that if it's discovered by the bad guys would mean you get compromised. So it's a very good idea to install. I always say install as little as you absolutely need.
Well
good.
I've been using
That's
Office 365
yeah.
Outlook
yeah.
On an Exchange server, oh. And I don't care much for Outlook, Apple Mail, or Webmail.
Now, Outlook, I understand, because Outlook has some bad habits, the worst of which is by putting everything, your email, your calendar, your address book, in one giant hairball of a file, the PST file. Even on Mac, it does this. And that's just a recipe for disaster. It's not it's a binary file. I just don't like that idea. In my opinion, the best way to handle email, at least, would be to keep it in text files and folders so that even if the email client, crashed or died, that email would still be readable.
Yeah.
You don't. What don't you like about Apple Mail? Just out of curiosity.
I just don't like the way it looks, and I'm just interested in looking to see if there's something that's better. I would like to get away from using an Exchange server and go to IMAP.
Good.
And I don't want to lose anything on the Exchange server.
Well, the easiest way to do that, almost all mail providers will have some way of sucking the email out of the old space. So if you went to Gmail, which is not true IMAP, but a kind of googly IMAP, you can have it set it to take all the mail off the old server and put it on the new server. Does your Exchange you're using some Exchange server that you rent, or where is this Exchange server?
GoDaddy.
Okay. So they're using Exchange, interesting. So they offer a managed Exchange. Exchange is Microsoft's email server, which is widely used in business, but I don't think anybody at home needs it. I would expect GoDaddy would have a way of exporting that mail, and if they don't, then I would look to your next email provider. I use and I recommend Fastmail, which is an Australian company, fastmail.com. They are a pure, good, and wholesome IMAP provider. And they would offer tools for getting the email, I believe, off the Exchange server. So once you get it into your new, fresh new home, you need an IMAP client on your computer, your brand new computer, to download the mail. And what's nice about that is you don't have to junk up your brand new computer with all the mail you've ever had. They'll store it for you. You can have just cached mail. You can decide how much storage you use. You could say, I only want to see the mail in the last 20 days, but I always want to be able to search the mail from previous. There's all sorts of flexibility IMAP provides. I think Apple Mail is probably the prettiest out there, but if you want something with a little more power, my favorite Mac mail client is called MailMate. MailMate. And it's from Freeron, F-R-E-R-O-N, Freeron.com, F-R-E-R-O-N.com. And single guy, one guy, he's been developing it for 10 years. It is, as he says, not the most widespread, cheapest, or greatest looking email client. But I don't want to be any of those. I want to be the most powerful, most flexible, most efficient, the most standards compliant. That should be a little star next to that one for you. And most secure email client. I really like MailMate. I've been very, very happy. You could try it free for 30 days. It's not very expensive if you want to buy it. And in fact, I donate money to the cause. He's a Danish single developer, lives in Copenhagen. And I donate just because I want him to keep doing it. There is another one that is a little more difficult to get running on Macintosh, but is quite nice, called Claws Mail. I use Claws on everything else, Windows, Linux. They do have a way to install it on Macintosh, but it's not as easy as just downloading a DMG file and installing it. But that's open source. There are many developers. Claws Mail is a little harder to use, but with its templating system is the most powerful email client I've ever used. And I like templates because I can start a reply, it'll automatically autofill parts of it. It's very powerful in that regard. So it might be worth taking a look at. However, as I said, getting it working on the Mac is maybe not quite as easy. It's really a Unix, Linux, and a Windows a mail program. I do love it, though. I wish I could get it working on. One of the things I like about Claws Mail is I can move my Claws Mail folder over to any computer, and it just is already set up. Makes it very easy. MailMate's a little harder to
do. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I just thought there wasn't a better time than right now to look around and to see what else is available.
Yeah. It's a brand new year. This is a good New Year resolution. You got a brand new computer. I would, at least for 30 days, try MailMate. I really like what he's done with it.
I'll do that. Do you have time for a short Echo story?
I do, but hold on a second. We're going to take a break. It gets to the bottom of the hour, and we have to take a little time out. And I will use this opportunity to ask people to add their favorite email clients to our website. It's free, no sign up, techguylabs.com. I'd like to know what you use. Huh? Yes. Jackie Kaplan Auerbach, flight attendant, my flight to the mother holding an infant. What's her name? Leia. Like Princess Leia? No. Like General Leia. Yeah, baby. She ain't no princess. I guess she still is, technically. Once a princess, always a princess.
Don't princesses become queens? Well,
I don't know if she ever became a queen. She's a general. And she's tough. Anyway, let me hear... Let me hear your I'm sorry. Let me hear, Terry, your Echo story. We're still on the podcast. So keep.
By the way, I appreciate you being so patient and talking to callers off the air, because there's not anybody else that does that.
Well, I'm bored otherwise. I just sit here looking at the looking at the ceiling waiting for the show. But we did, you know what? I have to say more people listen to the radio show probably than the podcast, but there's still 100,000 people listening. So I like to give the podcast listeners a little something extra while the radio folks are listening to commercials.
That's fine. Well, this was a little over a year ago. We were traveling home from Dallas to Amarillo, and we received a call that an intrusion alarm had gone off in our home.
Yikes.
And we were still about 100 miles from home. And I was able to use Echo to drop in to the living room and the bedroom and listen to see if anything was going on.
And was it?
Unfortunately. No. Fortunately, the only thing we heard was the police banging on the door.
Wow.
But that was, I just thought, what a cool thing. And, you know, I'm glad they weren't breaking in, but if they were, well, we might have been able to, you know, give.
You could have said something.
Information.
You said, get out of here. Get out of here.
Get out of my house and get off of my lawn.
Get off of my lawn, you kids. It's really, it's a different world. I mean, I never thought I'd put cameras in my house, but I have cameras all over the place. Just because I had to try out all these cameras. And now that I got them, I like them. I never thought of doing the drop-in to listen, though. That's a great idea. That's probably why our 16-year-old son has taken the Echo out of his room.
Well, you, now get, that I, you get a beat, but it's still surprising.
Now that I think of it. Hey, it's really nice to talk to you, Terry.
Good to talk to you, too,
Leo. Did you say you got the MacBook Air or MacBook Pro?
MacBook Pro.
Which one did you get?
13-inch. It's an i5.
Nice.
512 SSD, 8 gigs of RAM. I really wanted more, but I can work with 8.
So. Oh, 8 will be fine. Do you like it?
I do. I love it.
Yeah.
I know that you're not a fan of the touch bar, but I actually have already gotten really fond of it.
Oh, good.
I can use it with video.
Take a look at, there's a really nice little tool for it called Better Touch Tool. That's a third-party app that really lets the touch bars sing. Better
awesome.
Touch Tool. Hey, it's great to talk to you, Terry.
Good to talk to you, Leo. Take
have a, care. Have a great day. Bye-bye. I have to say, yeah, because Terry's right. I don't like the touch bar. I don't much like the keyboard either, although I'm grinning and bearing it. But I got the MacBook Air, and that is my go-to now. Because it's fast enough. It's got great battery life. Very happy with the battery life. And it's so light and, you know, I just whip it around. I still have my i9 MacBook Pro, but I end up reaching for the MacBook Air. If I were going to do Photoshop or something like that, I'd probably end up just doing that on the iMac anyway. Our show today brought to you by Brex. This is the credit card for startups. I love Brex. My first experience with Brex was so awesome. So Brex is the first corporate card for startups because A, it's easy to set up. A 5-minute online application. Underwriting, B, is based on your bank account, not your personal liability. There's no personal liability required. That means your company can get 10 to 20 times higher limits than other corporate credit cards with great high-value rewards and multipliers on the stuff you use the most. 7 times on rideshare, 3 times points on travel and restaurants, 2 times on software. There's no limit on how many points you can earn, and you can redeem points for statement credit on transactions. Money, 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 money. And exclusive offers with some of the best technology brands and services like AWS and Google and Salesforce and WeWork. It is easy. They're underwriting your company. Brex underwrites your company, not you. So there's no minimum operating history. Great for startups. No painful paper application. No personal liability. They use the cash raised by your business to extend credit. No credit score needed, no social security number, no deposit. It's a Visa card. It's a real card. And one of the things I love, I used it at a restaurant. I got a text immediately said, oh, we got your charge. Take a picture of the receipt. Oh, I took a picture of the receipt. They said, now you can throw it away. Is it this charge? Yes. We got it. We got it itemized. It's in your QuickBooks. Thank you very much. Wow. No more receipt envelope. And everyone in your company can have their own card with real-time limits that you can adjust. It is great. Get the card free, and Twit listeners get Brex card fees waived in perpetuity, but you got to go to brex.com/twit. Brex.com/twit. This is the corporate card. I mean, just there's no question. The one you want. Brex, brex.com/twit. We thank them for their support of the Tech Guy podcast. Leo Laporte, getting on the good foot. The Tech Guy, 8888. Ask Leo, the phone number. Love to hear from you. And as I mentioned, the website is a great place for you to put your, if you're yelling at the radio, good place for you to put your comments and your thoughts. TechGuyLabs.com. And it's free. I don't ask for your email. Actually, I should be clear. When you leave a comment, we make you use your Google or your Twitter or your Facebook. I think those are the three we use to sign in. And it's not because we want that information. We don't collect it. We don't care about it. But because we want to keep spammers at bay. And they, you know, and if we find somebody's using a Google account and they're spamming, we just block that and it makes it a lot easier. So that's the only reason. But it's, I think, a great resource. We've been doing it now almost 15 years. Mike B. in our chat room tells me my first book, which I wrote with Gina Smith, 101 Computer Answers You Need to Know. It's interesting. That number 101 keeps coming up, doesn't it? I wrote and published in March of 95. So that's, 24 years old in March. I learned pretty quickly, and I think Rich DeMuro, who has just written his new book, 101 Handy Tips for the iPhone, may learn as well that there is no money in computer books. There's no way to get rich. However, it's a great way to establish your name and in your profile and show yourself to be a serious computer journalist. And I think it did that for me. Looks like Rich did the smart thing in this one. I hope I'm not giving anything away, but he didn't bother going to a publisher. Nowadays, if you want to make a book, you'd be nuts to go to a publisher who's going to take a lot of money for nothing. You could do it all yourself through Amazon. Looks like that might be what Rich did. It's a perfectly legit book with illustrations and, you know, and all the stuff you would expect in a good book, including an about the author, a lovely picture of Rich on the back. And then you get most of the money instead of giving some to a publisher. In the old days, you had to have a publisher. There was no way to sell a book. How would you get a book in the bookstores? You'd have to go to bookstore after bookstore, one after the other, books in hand, saying, please. It's like the old days of music, where you'd have to go radio station to radio station. Please play my record. So the record labels and the book publishers really had a lock on it. And that's one thing the internet has just really improved, I think, is it's given everybody the chance to put books in people's hands or music in people's hands, because people no longer go to record stores and bookstores, at least not as their primary source of music and reading. They do it online. You can put a book at Amazon that looks, you know, just exactly like your publisher would put a book at Amazon. Amazon even has services that make it easy to publish. My daughter published a book of poetry doing that. And it costs you nothing. It costs you nothing. What you get is a beautiful book that's printed on demand. So you set the price. Amazon will charge you something for each print. But that will be less than the cover price. So it's all profit, baby. All profit. Amazon has a number of specialized sites for exactly this. It used to be CreateSpace. They've now turned it into Kindle Direct Publishing to make ebooks, print on demand for enterprise publishers to make paperback titles, and Amazon Media on Demand, where you could self-publish DVDs and audio CDs and sell them on Amazon. Which is why you may have noticed there's no record store in town, right? Maybe there is in most towns. And many towns, there's no bookstore in town, which makes me sad, but is in fact the case because people just buy it on Amazon. So maybe there is a reason to write a book these days. Maybe it's a better time to write books than ever before. I bet you it is, come to think of it. Don't ask me to do it. Let's go to Ontario, California. Milan is on the line. Hello, Milan.
Hey, how are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you?
Good, good. You are a hero. I've learned so much from your shows. Unbelievable.
Well, thank you. I mean, I don't run into burning buildings or anything like that, but I thank you for the kind words.
Okay, I saw your Jason's review and all that, and I bought OnePlus 6T.
Oh, yes.
I'm an AT&T customer, and the problem is AT&T doesn't support voice over Wi-Fi. So is there any way out of it? Because this phone is useless. Where I reside, there is no reception. Basically, one bar comes up. That's it.
We have that problem here in the studio with T-Mobile. A lot of us use T-Mobile. What you do is you go to AT&T and you say, I am going to stop being a customer because I don't get reception where I live. And then see what they say, what they will offer you. And what you want is them to offer this to you for free. But
They did enable LTE, But they said that voice over Wi-Fi is giving error messages. So we are not supporting OnePlus 6 to...
Oh, it's just on that phone. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, what I was going to suggest is something they call a femtocell. AT&T, that's the real name for it.
They discontinued it. It is no more.
They don't do a microcell anymore?
No.
I see it on their website.
They just support all what you have, but they don't give any more new cells.
Oh, that stinks.
You can buy on eBay the used ones.
Yeah.
That's selling.
So what that does is it plugs into your internet and then becomes a cell phone tower in your house.
It's not working now.
Oh, man.
They had given us, because we have five lines, and they said, okay, we'll give you. I'm paying almost $350 a month for five lines. And I'm not able to have...
I think it's time to change carriers. You know, you can bring your... Well, here's a couple of things. First of all, you can do Wi-Fi calling, just not over AT&T's network. You use Facebook Messenger or WhatsApp or some other third-party FaceTime or Skype or Google's Duo to make those phone calls. And then you'll be using data, not minutes. And it'll use your Wi-Fi, and it'll do it very well on that OnePlus phone.
Data is unlimited, but the problem is that people call me and they can't get it. The call doesn't come through.
Oh, if they call your regular number. Yeah. So the solution to that, unfortunately, might be, it's one free solution anyway, to set up a Google Voice number, which is a new number. And I use this, frankly, my number... No one knows the number to my actual smartphone because I have so many of them. I have a Google Voice number.
Right. I'm familiar with this concept you have told several times.
Yeah.
But then...
So you give that to everybody. And the beauty of that is it's like a redirect. Anywhere, any phone you want, including your home phone, your landline will ring when they call that number.
Right. But suppose if I buy Pixel 3 XL... Then will it support AT&T Wi-Fi calling?
I don't know, because I don't know. You have to call AT&T and say, tell me what phones. They may say, you have to buy it from us, which is ridiculous. But that's maybe what they're doing, because I see no technical reason why a OnePlus 6T wouldn't work with Wi-Fi calling on AT&T. I bet you anything they'll say, well, our iPhones do. And I'll bet you, and maybe the Pixel 3 will as well. The carriers, unfortunately, really want you to buy phones from them. They don't want you to buy what you've done, which is, in my opinion, the best thing of all, to buy an unlocked phone. Why don't they like that? Well, because you can go to another carrier like that. You just take the SIM out and you put somebody else's SIM in, and you're gone. And they want to lock you in. So they want to sell you a carrier locked phone from their vast supply. So, but I would ask them. I do not know off the top of my head whether the Pixel 3 XL works with AT&T Wi-Fi calling. You know who will, though? Somebody in our vast listening audience. So if you, so this is a call out to people in the chat room and anybody listening. He'd like to buy a Pixel 3, which, by the way, is an excellent phone. A little more expensive than the OnePlus 6T, but I really like it. And the best camera out there. And you buy it unlocked from Google. I know if you bought it from AT&T, it would work. Does it work if you buy it from Google? Chat room, listeners, tell me. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It has to be an AT&T branded OS. Yeah, that sounds like exactly like what I'd expect. They want you to buy it from AT&T. Just, yeah, right. One more reason not to deal with AT&T. These companies aren't really monopolies, but they sure act like it. And they charge you after the first 30 days. Of course they do. Of course they do. Yeah, that is one of the dirty secrets of Wi-Fi calling, is that the phone company isn't actually carrying the call. They're not doing any of the work. You're doing it on your internet service provider, but they still charge you minutes as if they were. Yeesh. Yeesh. Lurk's asking if this actually is a very good question. I'll need a new phone in 2019, says Lurk, but should I wait for 5G? It's kind of hard to know. It partly depends on what city you're living in. 5G rollouts are going to not be all at once. And it's going to depend on what carrier and what city you live in. A number of carriers are rolling out something they call 5G. I guess it's 5G, but they're doing it in very limited areas. Apple will not do a 5G phone, they've said, next year. It'll be 2020. I think 2020 might be the year. Qualcomm did announce, of course, its 5G mobile processor. So Android phones will have that capability at some point, possibly next year. Right now, the only 5G phone out there isn't a 5G phone, but it's a Moto G with a, or a Moto X, I guess, with a pogo pins on the back that you could add a 5G module that they will make someday. So it could be upgraded, maybe. Samsung and Verizon say they'll launch a 5G smartphone early next year. AT&T and Sprint. I think it's going to be honestly more than a year before we see 5G everywhere. So you got to figure out if you're going to get 5G in your neck of the woods. Here's a link. Let's put this in the show notes. Thank you, Scooter X, to the 35 devices, all of which you buy from AT&T that will work with Wi-Fi calling. iPhone XR, LG V40, iPhone XS, XS Max, Note 9, A6 from Galaxy, Razer Phone 2, iPhone X, iPhone 8 Plus, Galaxy S9 Plus, LG V35 ThinQ, Think, LG K30. These are all sold by AT&T, so... And because the 6T is not sold by AT&T, there's no reason it won't work, in my opinion. I mean, maybe there is, but I bet you it's not. Yeah, you'll have to have a 5G radio in it. So that's, you know, the 855 or the likes. Yeah, AT&T calls the femtocells microcells. Every company has its own brand name. I didn't realize it discontinued it. Thank you, AT&T. Another reason AT&T sucks. I pay them $300 a month. I wish I didn't. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo, the phone number. 888-827-5536. Somebody in the chat room asked a really good question. I hope I don't sound surprised. That happens all the time. He said, I want to get a 5G phone next year. Should I? Don't fall for the hype. Don't fall for the hype machine, which is really ramping up for 5G. Remember, the same thing happened for LTE when we moved from 3G to 4G and then LTE, that all the companies said, oh, yeah, we're going to have... We're going to have LTE, high speed, and then it took a long time. 5G is similar. In fact, 5G is pretty hard to implement for a cell phone company. So the first thing that will have to happen is you'll have to have a 5G compatible phone. There'll have to be a radio. This is the new data standard, I should say, what this is. It's fifth generation. So there was 3G, third generation, then 4G, fourth generation, which... basically is LTE. The fifth generation is a bigger jump, very high speed, but it's going to be really something you'll only get in densely populated urban areas. It will require a phone with 5G compatibility. All the phone companies say they're going to sell something like that in the early part of next year, or for at least first half of next year. Qualcomm 855 chip, something like that. Probably Android, because I don't think Apple will jump on the 5G train this year or next year. Probably the rumors are in 2020. So fall 2020, almost 2 years from now. That's not unreasonable. First of all, Apple never is first on any train. They always wait till it's a mature technology and then put it out. But also, I think Apple quite rightly feels that most of its customers won't even be able to get 5G until 2020. And here's why. 5G is a micromillimeter technology. You know, we talk about band frequency bands. The higher the frequency, the worse it goes through walls. And cell phones are generally have been, you know, lower, you know, your lower frequency. That way they can get through walls better. But as they get to, you know, they started still microwave frequencies, 2.4 gigahertz. As they get to higher frequencies, like the millimeter wave frequencies of 5G, they won't travel as far and they won't travel as well. So in order to implement a 5G network, a phone company has to have lots of cell towers, many more than they need now. And that's always been a problem, putting up cell towers. No one wants a cell tower in their backyard. There's even an acronym for it, NIMBY. Not in my backyard. So getting these cell towers out is going to be a challenge. The companies that have announced 5G, and there are a couple of them, are only announcing them in small areas of big cities. So the first question, way to answer your question is, where do you live? If you live in one of the cities that the big guys are going to be rolling out 5G, and then you maybe have a chance of getting it. But what they don't tell you is that it won't even probably be the whole city. It'll be a small region in that city. And they don't tell you how long before it gets to the whole city and then how long to the whole country. It almost certainly won't really be available in rural areas because of the requirement to put many, many more cell towers. It's just not, you know, financially feasible in an area that's thinly populated. You need to have lots of customers in an area for it to be worthwhile. We also don't know about pricing. Will there be a special fee? Will there be more speed tiers? AT&T has talked a little bit about pricing. And they're going to be playing a lot of tricks. The man in charge of AT&T's consumer wireless and video business, David Christopher, spoke at Mobile World Congress. He said,
"Business models are still evolving. And there's an opportunity for new consumer consumption models."
Where's my cash register sound effect? Ka-ching! That's a carrier speak for money, 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 money.
An opportunity for new consumer consumption models.
Rather than paying, for instance, a standard flat fee, you might be paying a little extra if you want to do some gaming. And you want low latency, because that's one of the things 5G offers. And, of course, remember what happened with LTE. When the speeds went up, consumption went up. And when consumption goes up, your bill goes up. And this has all happened slowly enough so that we're like frogs in a pot of water. The temperature's gone up bit by bit. We didn't even notice we're getting boiled to death. Have you looked at your cell phone bill lately? It's huge. And the reason it is because, data consumption has gone up through the roof. Even if you have unlimited data, there's no such thing. So expect more of that. Expect more shenanigans. And we just don't know yet what those shenanigans are going to look like. So 5G, you need to get a new phone. Okay, there will be some new phones coming out. Should you buy that? I wouldn't, unless you live in an area where they've already announced we're going to have 5G and you've looked at the price. Because it's almost certain carriers will use this. They'll use anything they can to raise the prices on us. So speed is improved with 5G, but as I mentioned, low latency, that's a problem with gaming. I don't know if you've ever played one of these first-person shooters, but it can't take a while too long for your packet to get to the internet and then get to the other guy and then get back from the other guy to you. If that takes more than, let's say, 50 milliseconds, you're going to go around a corner and the bad guy's going to wax you because you don't know the bad guy's even there for a while. It has to be very low latency. And actually, they say that they can get 5G latencies down to 1 millisecond. That's pretty good. That'll make a big difference, not just in gaming, but in Skype and other things. Or or a surgeon controlling a pair of robotic arms in New York on an operation in San Francisco, that kind of thing. Latency is really important. So it's a big pipe because of the high frequency, but that means these millimeter wave towers will have to be closer together. So they're going to put in a lot more towers. It's going to be very expensive to do that. Oh, one more problem. The 5G equipment that everybody wants to use is made by a little company called Huawei. Chinese company. Founder was former Chinese military, and maybe you heard. The founder's daughter, their CFO, was arrested in Canada this week at the request of the United States Department of Justice. They say that she created a phony shell company so that Huawei could sell gear to Iran under the sanctions. The U.S. government did not like Huawei. I don't know what carriers are doing, but they're going to look to, they can't put in Huawei equipment in the United States, so they're going to look to somewhere else. So you need a new phone. you need an X50 modem from Qualcomm, or if you're an Apple person, you're going to need to wait till Apple comes along, which is going to be a while. You'll need to be in an area where 5G exists. You'll need to be able to afford it. And I suspect the rollouts of 5G are going to be slowed down a little bit by the fact that these companies can't buy Huawei equipment. Who's the number one manufacturer of 5G equipment in the world? Huawei. Who is some company, country is ripping all of their Huawei gear out because of fears of Chinese spying. That's one issue. The Chinese can see all the signals. They spy on them for industrial espionage. And then, of course, the threat that maybe they'll throw a switch and kill your entire network as part of a cyber warfare. So in Canada, they're removing Huawei gear. British Telecom is avoiding Huawei. They've been banned from the network. It's a mess. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. If you've got data on the internet, if you've got websites and apps with passwords, you know that the password is the weak link in there. That's why you want to get LastPass to manage your passwords, to manage your private stuff. It's the perfect lockbox. For passwords, I put my passports, driver's license, social security numbers, any data I want to keep safe but away from prying eyes, I put in LastPass. And this is double for business again. LastPass Enterprise, we use it here. In fact, I believe so firmly in LastPass, and I've been using it for almost a decade since they came out. And Steve Gibson vetted it for me. He talked to the creator of LastPass, looked at the source code. Joe Segrist was very generous. And said, yeah, this works. They're doing it right. So he started using it. I use it in business now because we get 100 policies. We can configure master password requirements, password resets. I can restrict access if an employee leaves. I get security reports. We've got shared folders. So ops has a folder. Business has a folder. That way, only the people who need passwords can get them. We put everything in there, too. Database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, all our business information. The password generator in LastPass means that you will always have long, strong passwords. Yeah, they're hard to remember, but don't worry. LastPass remembers them for you automatically. It's awesome. The LastPass Authenticator app pops up an approve-deny window on your phone. No long six-digit code to remember. You just say approve, and the login is approved. And that way, you've got two-factor on everything. Look, more than 16 million people trust LastPass. It's the number one most preferred password manager. You can use it at home, LastPass Premium. I use LastPass Families with our family so we can share passwords. And, of course, LastPass Teams for small teams, LastPass Enterprise for businesses. Take control of your business passwords. Reduce the threat of breach. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit today. It's a love affair. We love LastPass. They saved my bacon more than once. You will too. LastPass.com/twit. Verizon 5G in Indianapolis. Thank you for that link. Mike B., who lives in New Jersey and is getting Fios, knows everything there is to know about 5G in Indy. Oh, this is their home service. Network speeds around 300 megabits. That's pretty good. Peak speeds of nearly a gigabit with no data caps. Yeah, right. These are pre-rollout estimations. Real-life usage will have to be tested. How much does 5G cost? Well, at launch, the pricing is simple. The service will cost $50 a month for current Verizon Wireless customers. Non-Verizon customers will pay $70 a month. No hardware costs, as all Verizon... This is a test, so we don't know if this is indicative of anything in the future. All 5G customers are provided with the necessary equipment, which may include an indoor or outdoor receiver, a router, and a Wi-Fi extender that will continue to be owned by the company, and you cannot use it for any other purpose. Or as USA Today says, and you cannot be used it for any other purpose. Whatever happened to editors? And you cannot be used it for any other purpose. Are there any promotions, USA Today asks. Actually, it's the Indy Star, part of the USA Today network. Let's get that right. Are there any promotions to help me save some cash? First 3 months free to any customer who signs up. You'll either get a free Apple TV 4K or a Google Chromecast Ultra device to installation and 3 months of free YouTube TV. Free stuff. Where do I sign up? Not so fast. First, you need to find out if your home is in an optimal place to receive 5G service. So go to the Verizon 5G home website, enter your address, and see if you can get service. But Verizon cautions, the service requires a direct line of sight between our 5G cell site and your residence. Because of this, some residents on the same block may have 5G home coverage while others may not. Will my cell phone be faster? No. Not until you get a new cell phone. John Ledger on T-Mobile tweets, I cannot begin to explain how important 5G is going to be for this country, so I have to say congrats to Verizon on delivering its 5G home service today. It doesn't use global industry standards or cover whole blocks and will never scale, but hey, it's first, right? Meanwhile, he says, we have a different vision. T-Mobile will have 5G across the country in the new T-Mobile build. Then the new T-Mobile, which is the T-Mobile plus Sprint, will build a 5G network that's both broad and deep nationwide. Ask Verizon if their proprietary, non-standards 5G will eventually work on any phones in the market. Spoiler, they won't. 5G, Verizon's using its own standard called 5G TF. The industry standard is 5G NR. And this is exactly why you should not run out and buy a 5G phone. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We got your smartphones. We got your smart watches. We got all that jazz, everything with a chip in it. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. On line four, Bruce, Long Island, New York. Hello, Bruce. Welcome to the show. Hey, Bruce.
Bruce. Hello, Bruce.
Oh, you know what? You're not Bruce. Bruce, you're next. It's Roy in Orange County, California. I pressed the wrong button. Hello, Roy.
Leo, how are you?
I am well. Welcome.
I'm talking to you on a blue parrot, so it sounds a little bit different than usual.
I love those blue parrots, though. I have one at home. This is a USB headset widely used by truckers because of its...
I am a trucker.
Incredible noise cancellation.
Yeah, I am a trucker. So,
there you go.
Listen, I was lurking. I am lurking in the chat room.
Oh, hi, Lurk. We were talking earlier. Yeah.
I asked that question about 5G.
Yeah.
That was an excellent discussion. You
got your answer from the chat question. Well, it's a good question. Now, you're in a different boat because you're getting all... Are you a cross-country trucker? Do you drive everywhere?
Yes.
Yeah. So 5G particularly will be, you know, interesting for you because you'll go from areas that have it to areas that don't and vice versa. I honestly don't think we're going to see robust 5G for a couple of years at least.
Well, I can wait a couple of years. Yeah. I've got an application that I'm developing for locating wireless, driverless and autonomous trucks. So I'm going to need that latency or lack of latency.
Yeah. Well, tell me about this application. What is it going to do?
Well, it's going to allow a driverless semi, which are testing right now, to be maneuverable in in close quarters, like shipping yards and that sort of thing. And I want to be able to fully automate the truck without a driver in order to park it and move it into a dock and that sort of thing.
Wow. So do you have any experience with the current crop of self-driving trucks?
Yes, I do. I'm pretty much a subject matter expert on them. There's two or three more outfits in California that are working on them. Embark is one. TU Simple or Too Simple is based in San Diego with testing facilities in Tucson. They're a Chinese company. They're making a lot of progress. There's a company closer to you in Mountain View, I believe, called Starsky Robotics, which is working on driverless. And then there's a couple of others that have just cropped up. One is called Kodiak, and one is called Ike, I-K-E. And they're all up in the Bay Area.
Wow, isn't that interesting? Now, reassure those of us in the general public who are terrified about the idea of a massive 18-wheeler with nobody at the wheel barreling down the highway. Are these going to be safe?
Well, yes. And the caveat there is that they have to be very thoroughly, very thoroughly tested. And that's going to take another couple of years before the government, particularly the DOT and FMCSA or whatever it's called, is going to allow these things to be licensed. Right
yeah.
now, the technology is being tested with us with a commercial driver.
It's all experimental. Yeah.
Yes.
Then do you have to have a safety driver now? But in the long run, will it be completely driverless? There'll be nobody in the cab.
Yes, I believe so.
Holy cow!
So.
Trucks are well suited to this because, for most of the ride, they're going down long stretches of highway, which is, of course, the easiest thing for a self-driving vehicle to navigate. It's city streets that are tough. What happens when the truck gets to the city street, takes an exit?
Well, it's operating as it was operating on the highway, and it's. I believe it's going to be practical and safe because they're using an enormous number of sensors on top of that truck cab, not the trailer, the cab. And that includes video, something called LIDAR, which is light detecting radar. And radar also, and I just stumbled over a new technique for the use of ground penetrating radar. So there's a tremendous amount of technology going into all this, but what's important to know is that the two companies I mentioned first, Embark and Too Simple, are already operating with a safety driver on interstates, not in the cities yet, because the driver takes over for that.
Right.
And there haven't been any incidents. You know, Uber killed somebody last year, but that's Uber. You know, they're
well. And I also we should be fair. Anytime an autonomous vehicle hits somebody or gets in an accident, that's headline stories. But people get killed by human drivers every minute of every day. And it's no longer news because it's so commonplace. So
exactly. Something like 40,000 deaths
yeah, it's,
a year.
It's horrific.
In the United
it's
States.
Carnage. So it's your opinion that this will make the roads a safer place?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because that carnage will diminish and then eventually go away. That's the upside. The downside is that there's going to be a lot of drivers like me that are going to be out of jobs. You know, but, you know, the average driver is 54 years old.
And, oh, interesting.
And basically they're going to attrit more than they're going to be, you know, laid off.
Right. This is the fear, you know, something like something over 1% of the entire workforce in the United States drives for a living, whether it's trucks or cabs. Yeah, it's more than 1%. And if, you know, with the rapid onset of self-driving vehicles, that's a lot of people potentially out of work.
Absolutely, including Uber and Lyft drivers, and I've
that's
driven
right.
both. But eventually, you know, they're gonna. That's a huge business opportunity to get because the driver, like when I drove for Lyft, they took 20% of the value of the drive, plus they added on a bunch of
fees. Oh, I know.
So
neither Lyft nor Uber makes any money even when they do that, because drivers are expensive. In both cases, I think the companies are set up to make money only when they don't need drivers anymore. So
that's correct. Uber has never shown a profit.
No, they've lost billions.
Right.
The thing I worry about with self-driving vehicles, and I have a kind of semi-autonomous Tesla, is humans. The real problem is humans. If everything were autonomous, if every vehicle on the road were autonomous, then there wouldn't be any issues because the cars could negotiate with one another. I don't think you'd see many accidents. It's the humans that are mixed in with those semis that are the problems. It's a problem for human drivers, I know, big trucks as well. The guy who cuts you off doesn't realize you don't have much stopping room, and you know your visibility is limited in the cab and all of those things, and the humans are the big threat anyway.
Right. Now, Google Waymo has really made some advances in that area. In fact, they're going commercial finally in Phoenix. They're starting to.
I know you can get a Waymo to Walmart.
Right. Exactly.
It's a fascinating subject. We've talked quite a bit about it, but I am thrilled to talk to some. And you're smart. You're developing skills in another area. You're actually going to help build the technology for these guys.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one
great idea.
I just got out of a coding camp. So
great. I'm thrilled to hear it. I'm going to have to take your question in a minute because we got to take a little break. But hang on, because I'm fascinated by all this, Roy. I appreciate it. It's great to talk to you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Take a little time out. Again, back to your calls, 8888-ASK-LEO. Website, techguylabs.com. We'll talk after this. Sorry to have to do that to you, Roy, but I'm so glad you called. I love it. We're going to have to make you our self-driving truck expert.
I would love to do that. In fact, I predict that you're going to have a self-driving segment on your, podcast.
I think you're right.
Library in another year or two, maybe sooner.
It's coming. Of course, the issue is not so much technology. Yeah. The issue is regulatory approval, as you pointed out, and customer acceptance. But
and the good news there, Leo, is that the government seems to be kind of favorable.
Yeah.
And politically, it's what you said earlier, if fewer people are going to die, period.
What we'll put it over is the insurance companies. As soon as insurance companies say, look, you got to do this, and they go to Congress and they take their pet members of Congress and say, you got to do this, it'll happen. And I think that's going to happen fast. It's funny because when I bought my Tesla, the insurance company said, does it have self-driving features? I said, yes. They said, you plan to use them? I said, well, yeah. They said, okay, that'll cost you. They charged me more, even though I know I'm a safer driver thanks to those features. But that's going to shift very quickly.
Well, you've got an X, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I test drove one a couple of weeks ago, and we went into self-driving mode on the Costa Mesa Freeway down here. And boy, it was great. It ran really.
Oh, I agree. I mean, for stop and go traffic, I use it all the time. I use it anytime I'm on the highway. I use it. I always keep my hands on the wheel, and they're really got a lot of safeguards to make sure you do that, including at one point, if you don't do it, they'll disable it. They'll say, sorry, you can't use it anymore. you're not paying attention. But
I was extremely impressed with it.
Yeah, I think it works quite well. I've tried the new Cadillac has a similar feature, although it doesn't have to feel you with a torque sensor on the wheel. It capacitively knows your hands on the wheel, which I like that a little bit better.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
For $100,000, it needed to impress me.
Yes, they're not cheap. And now, I'm going to be testing the. I'm all in on electric now. And in fact, electric trucks are the other big thing coming along, right?
Yeah, that's going to be a range and refillability.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So they can't. I'm acquiring my own truck and trailer next year, and the big problem I see is who's going to provide the electricity out in Wyoming, and
right.
How long is it going to take to recharge?
Well, that's an interesting question. I was talking to our car guy who's here. He's going to let me drive the new Jaguar I-Pace this afternoon. He says that Porsche / Audi, as part of their Dieselgate settlement, is doing Electrify America with 350-watt chargers every 140 miles all over America. I think that's going to be one of the solutions. Hold on a sec. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, having a great conversation with Roy. He's a trucker turned computer programmer. It was also made himself an expert in self-driving trucks. But you called with a question. I don't want to use up all your time. So what was your question, Roy?
Well, I think only you can answer this. I hope you can. I'm a big user of cloud storage, like OneDrive, Dropbox,
you bet,
and Google Drive. And, you know, I use a number of machines during the day, a couple of laptops, a couple of towers. And I've noticed, and it seems to be a problem with all three of those that I mentioned, these things have trouble syncing. And I'm not sure why, and there's no command set that I can find that tells, like, OneDrive, go sync yourself. And I've asked Microsoft about it, and you get this, you know, they can't really tell me what the problem is. And
no, because it's supposed to work, right?
Exactly. Because, like, I'll create a folder locally on a machine I'm using, and then I go to another machine, and which is on my home network, and I won't see the folder. And there also seems to be a difficulty between, you know, looking at these services online via a browser versus looking at them locally.
Right. Like, so when you look in a browser, you're looking at their cloud-based storage, which should be up to date. When you're looking at your computer, you're looking to see which things have been synced down. I use all of these services regularly. Google's Drive and Dropbox both have desktop clients, and go in the settings and make sure you've got it set up so that you choose which folders will sync. I usually do selective sync because I don't want to sync them all. I also use, and I've had it to be very reliable, my NAS. I use a Synology NAS, and it has its own Synology Drive solution, which does the same thing, except instead of syncing to a cloud, it's syncing to my network-attached storage in my closet at home. So I don't have a cloud in public, but I have a cloud drive at home that syncs to all of my devices, and I found that works really well. There's one other solution you might want to look at that is a third-party synchronization service that is cross-storage. So it works with all of them, Box, iCloud, Google Drive, Dropbox, every cloud in out there. Amazon's cloud actually doesn't work, I think, with Apple's solution. Nothing works with iCloud because Apple doesn't want it to, but it works with everything else. It's called ODrive, and you let it do the syncing, and it will merge all of these if you wish. You have a lot of control. I found it to have a lot of control. ODrive.com, and you can use it with Google, Dropbox, you know, Microsoft's OneDrive, and it will have unified storage. And I think it does a better job syncing than the individual sync engines. So I used ODrive for a long time. And it also, I think it's got zero-knowledge encryption. It's a really interesting solution. And I believe it's free, at least, you know, there's a free version. And then if you want, you could pay for the premium version.
ODrive?
No, Drive, D-R-I-V-E, like driving your big rig down the highway. ODrive. ODrive.com. Give that a try. I haven't had any of these problems you're reporting, however. I have to point out, I use all of the services out there. I don't use, I don't know if iCloud, of course, is Mac only. No, I take it back. They have a Windows version. I've never used it on Windows. It'll do sync. I guess they all will. I generally stick with either Dropbox or using my own Synology NAS sync. But when I have a documents folder on every computer I use, and I, as you might imagine, have quite a few, so I'm always trying out computers. I install the Synology software, the drive software on a computer. It's one of the first things I install. And I say, synchronize that documents folder with the NAS, with the network attached storage, the big drive at home. And it's about a terabyte of data. No, I'm sorry. It's not that much. Can't be. It's about 100 gigabytes of data. There you go. So it takes a little while to synchronize. But at that point, if I make a change to any file on any of my computers in the documents folder, it will automatically propagate to all my other computers. And I do that, and I imagine this is why you might do that as a truck driver. I do that so that no matter what computer I'm using, I have the same set of important documents. It works quite well. That's network-attached storage, so you have to go out and buy your own hardware. You're not storing it in somebody else's cloud. You're storing it in your cloud. And even though you do have to pay for most of these services, their storage is so cheap. Even though you're paying a subscription fee, it's probably cheaper to do that than it is to buy your own hardware. I just like having my own hardware. 88, and Roy, stay in touch. I want to keep talking about the future of self-driving because I think this is a Roy said off the air, and I think he's right. This it's the next few years or so, this show is probably going to have a self-driving segment just talking about this stuff. Bruce, Long Island. Sorry, you're on now finally. Sorry to tease you last segment. Welcome. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, Leah, how you doing?
I'm great. What can I do for you?
I called you about 6 weeks ago and asked you some advice about doing a dual boot. I was looking either to buy a Mac or a PC, and I wound up getting a MacBook Pro.
Good.
15-inch with 16 gigs
nice.
Of RAM and
super.
A terabyte hard drive.
Very nice. And are you running Windows on that?
Well, I'm running Windows 10 and a Mac OS.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, it works great. And the reason I did that was because I use Windows for work.
Right.
And I don't want to carry around two computers.
Perfect reason to do that. Walt Mossberg, the now retired columnist at the Wall Street Journal, said the best Windows machine you can buy is a MacBook.
Right? I remember that quote.
He might be right, yeah. So what can I do for you today?
Well, so my situation is that I'm trying to use external monitors with the Mac, and I'm not used to doing it with a Mac. So I know with a Windows computer, I had two 24-inch monitors at work, and you're able to use them as if they're one monitor.
Yes.
So I'd like a solution, and I don't know if there's a
this
KVM.
This is funny because it's even easier on the Mac than it is on Windows. It's just plug and play. So So the only issue is going to be the number of ports you have. And on that MacBook Pro, of course, you only have a couple of ports. So what you'll want to do is get a dock that has more ports. Get a Thunderbolt 3 dock if you can afford it. I get them from Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com. They're a couple hundred bucks. But then you can run – I have three monitors running off my Mac. And it just happens. It just works. You can, of course, mirror, but you want what's called extended monitors so that as you move the mouse off the left screen – of the center monitor goes to the left monitor. Off the right screen, it goes to the right monitor. And you can move windows there. And I have three. It's the best way to work in the world. Three monitors. Lots of real estate. You can keep programs running in the background. And you have a lot of RAM, so that's an easy thing to do. Mostly, I think getting a dock will solve this for you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I had to take a break, but keep going.
Yeah.
Did you want a KVM for some other reason? Or?
No, I was wondering if I needed a KVM.
No.
I know you need it for a PC.
No. It's it's
great.
So much easier on a Mac. This is, I think, not an unusual problem. The Windows people go, well, wait a minute. How am I supposed to do this? Nothing. You plug in the monitors.
Okay, well, that's perfect.
Yeah. So.
Well, my other question, though, is, okay, so I'm used to with a PC using a 24-inch screen. Should I just buy like one big monitor instead of buying two?
Honestly, if I had to do it all over again, I'm using an iMac, so that's a little bit different. It already has a screen. But if I had to do it all over again, I would get a monitorless Mac, like an iMac, and a Mac Mini, and then get one of those big, wide, 34-inch, super wide screens. Because the advantage of doing that, you still get the real estate of two or three screens, but you don't have bezels. It's just one continuous display, and the Mac will absolutely handle that. There are a number of companies that make these. LG is probably the best, but Dell has them. A lot of companies have them. These ultra-wide displays, I think, are the future of displays. I really like this idea. And, of course, if you game at all, It's an amazing gaming experience. So LG makes for $400, for instance, a 21x9, 34-inch ultra wide. So it's very inexpensive. It has some of them. This one's not curved. Some of them are curved, and you'll see why as soon as you set it up. You kind of aren't. You know, you're looking around. It's so big. You have to look to see the whole screen. Because you're sitting fairly close to it. I think they're just fantastic. So if I were now, given you have a laptop, one of the nice things you could do with the MacBook is hook up one monitor, get one with the Thunderbolt connection, plug it into the laptop, close the laptop, just put it aside. Don't even use the laptop screen. And if you have a standalone keyboard and a mouse, plug those into the monitor. And now the Mac stays alive, even though it's closed. You've got a desktop. When you want to go, you unplug the monitor, you go, and you got everything there. It's a great way to work.
Well, that's what I wanted to do. Okay, yep. So that answers my question.
Apple does it beautifully. I can't promise it'll work in boot camp. It should, because Apple provides the drivers for boot camp. So, probably it'll be the same.
No, I'm using VM.
Oh, it'll absolutely work in VMware, yeah.
Yeah, I'm using VMware. So, yep. Okay, that's great. Wow, terrific.
The problem is it was too easy.
Well, yeah. No, I want to ask you another unrelated question.
Okay.
I have a, this is maybe a Scott question, but I want to get a sound bar. I have a Samsung 65-inch 4K UHD TV, and I'm looking to get a sound bar. And I noticed, I think you guys recommended in the past Vizio.
Yeah, he really likes the Vizios. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that Vizio integrates, though, with the Google the Google Home thing, but I'm invested in Echo. So
yeah, we had, and I'm pretty sure it had Echo built into it, an LG sound bar. I know it sounded like the LG guy that was really good. It had Atmos capability as well. And of course, there's a sound bar from Sonos. It's a little pricey, but it has Amazon's Echo built into it too. The Echo or the Beam, I think it's called, the Sonos Beam, and it's a really nice sound bar. And if you want, you can add subwoofers and surrounds using the Sonos system. The only negative on it, it's a little bit pricey. I can't remember how much. I think $699, something like that. But it's wireless, and it does all the Sonos. Oh, sorry, $399. Oh, that's not bad. And it does all the Sonos stuff as well as the Amazon Echo stuff.
Yeah, no, I've always wanted a Sonos, but
there you go. Get the Beam.
I think I'm ready to go with that.
Go for the Beam. It's a great choice. Hey, I got to run.
Yeah. All right, thank you, Leo. I appreciate it.
Take care. Oh, have you seen any good TV lately? I see good TV all the time because I've got Curiosity Stream. It is the world's first streaming service that scratches the itch we all have to learn. To learn, to explore, to understand. It was created by John Hendricks. He's the guy who created the Discovery Channel. But Curiosity Stream is so much better. First of all, it's very affordable. Plans start at just $2.99 a month, $2.99 a month with unlimited access. They have a premium plan, which includes Ultra HD and 4K streaming. Thousands of documentaries and nonfiction series. Just the best stuff. And, of course, Curiosity Stream has apps for all your platforms, Roku, Android, Xbox One, smart TVs, iOS, Chromecast. You'll find a Curiosity Stream on the Amazon Fire, on the Amazon Kindle, on the Apple TV. We tend to watch it on Roku, on Apple TV, but it's everywhere. You can even watch it on your phone. And unlike a lot of these networks, it's available worldwide. So if you're listening to us outside the U.S., I know a lot of times Canadian listeners go, oh, you can't get it. You can get it. It's everywhere. Science, nature, history. I like to watch history a lot. I, of course, have to watch technology. They cover society and lifestyle, too. There's award-winning documentaries. Stephen Hawking's favorite places. The Hunt for Dark Matter. I love cosmology. The Birth of the Internet. Cyber War. And, of course, much, much more. If you go to curiositystream.com/twit, you can see some of the 2,000-plus amazing nonfiction and documentary programs. And you'll get a great deal. Unlimited access to the world's top documentaries and nonfiction series and your membership free for the first month, but you got to use the promo code TWIT. CuriosityStream, AT&T.com/twit. And use the code TWIT and get a month free. Lots of great stuff. Oh, look, there's Muhammad Ali. There's the space program, Destination Mars, the history of food, the butterfly effect, the birth of the internet, Pearl Harbor. We just had Pearl Harbor Day, right? A couple of days ago. The 4K footage from unexplored areas of the battleship wreckage. Pearl Harbor into the Arizona. Wow. You're going to really love it. CuriosityStream.com/twit. Try it for free for a month. Chris Marquardt is here, author of the brand new wide-angle photography book, which I love. Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it. It's a great book. I have some sad news. Chris is going on a two-month vacation in a couple of weeks. So he'll
almost.
Oh man, he's going to be gone through March. So a couple more Chris Marquardt segments, and then he's going to disappear a little bit. But we'll get him back on. And what it means is we'll have a 2 month photo assignment. But that's okay. That's okay.
We can do that.
I think we can do that. We've done it before. We'll do it again. What do you want to talk about this week in terms of digital photography, Chris?
Well, there's a few things going on right now that I find interesting and that I want to discuss with you. Open your web browser, search for boyfriends of Instagram.
What? As you may or may not know, I have gotten off Instagram and all social media because I don't want to support Facebook in any way. But boyfriends of Instagram.
Well, it's a kind of a humorous look at a phenomenon that we've seen for quite a while now, with people being professional Instagrammers, pretty much.
Yes.
They travel to locations, and that is a take on the people behind the cameras and their weird.
Oh yeah, because the travel.
Someone has to take those photos.
Yeah,
you know?
The Instagram travel bloggers tend to be attractive young women. And so there's somebody taking the picture of the attractive young woman. That's the boyfriend.
And it's often the boyfriend. I mean,
Instagram.
It's a bit of a stereotype, but yeah, that's what's going on there.
There's actually an entire account called Boyfriends of Instagram.
Oh, there's tons of blogs and Tumblrs and stuff about that. And it's a funny, humorous look into a bit of a business that is kind of strange. And Instagram has this tendency of making a lot of people go to the same locations.
Yes. So here's an example. This is the bean in Chicago, that reflective bean that everybody seems to have to take a picture of.
Well, and I don't blame them. I would take a picture of the bean myself if I was there. So absolutely. I mean, those landmarks are amazing, but what's happening is that some of those natural landmarks out in nature get a bit of a problem. You might have, and Instagram is getting problems too. You might have heard of Taft Point in Yosemite National Park, which is this rock overhang over. Well, you can take a picture of that from the side, and it looks very dangerous. And it's like a, I don't know, 600-foot drop or something along those lines. And people, of course, want to take their picture while on there, and people have fallen off it because of that. So the problem is locations are getting more and more attention thanks to social media. And Instagram is just one of the areas where people post pictures with location tags. And location tags are really turning into a bit of an issue.
This is so depressing to me.
It kind of is, yeah.
We were in on the Amalfi Coast in September, Positano, a beautiful Italian town built on a hillside. It's so picturesque. Looks so beautiful when you see the pictures on Instagram. You get there, and there's 8 million people taking pictures. Yeah. It's so crowded, you can't move. And our guide said, yeah, come back at Christmas, because there's no way. All those pictures are either edited or taken at Christmas. There's no way.
Now there's one location that is trying to, well, has started a campaign against that, against location tags. It's called Jackson Hole in Wyoming.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful and
their travel and tourism board has launched that campaign with like things like tag responsibly. Keep Jackson Hole wild.
Tag responsibly. Pretend you're in Israel. Don't tell them where you are.
Well, don't put tags in there. I mean, so here's some of their slogans. Yeah. One little tag, one big problem. Or,
oh, that's really interesting. How many
likes is a patch of dead wildflowers worth? Post the photo, trash the location tag.
Oh, wow. It's
a real campaign they're doing right now.
This is a small microcosm of the problem with social media in general. There's something about it. We love it. We are addicted to it. But as a result, we overrun, you crush anything you love.
I've just recently ran into this myself. And while I, on the photo tours, I try to, of course, go to locations that don't have tourists, and we do not post the geotags.
Oh, that's
and
so funny.
I make a point of not doing this. In Ireland, it happened to us that we wanted to go to a beach, a beautiful beach for photography, and this has turned into an attraction. So the farmer that you need to go through a farmer's field to get to the beach. The beach is public. The farmer's field is not. But he never had a problem if like a couple of photographers went through his field. But now it has come to a point where he put a sign up saying no social media posts, no drones.
Wow.
And he put a bull in the field so that you
unless you want to get
incentivize
you. Yes, unless you want to visit with my bull, stay out.
Yeah. So this is really an interesting development, and I think the culprits, of course, are platforms that kind of by default put location tags on and point out the location. So Instagram is at the forefront of that, and others are too. Others are doing this too, but Instagram, I think, still puts the location. If there's a location tag in your photo, it puts it on there. So I'm
Stop
really
tagging.
Adamant. I've always been to not location tag the photos.
That's interesting. Yes, Trucker Tim in our chat room is saying this has always been a problem. I mean, part of the problem is there's just too many people. When I was a kid in 1967, we went to visit Stonehenge in Great Britain, and you could walk around on the Salisbury Plain. You could walk around the lintels.
That's long over.
You could go in there, and in the 70s, they blocked it off so people couldn't go in there because it would have ruined it eventually.
I mean, it's probably also a symptom of the fact that everyone now has at least a couple of cameras, You have a camera with you all the time, and social media have turned into this culture of like having to self-promote yourself to get yourself out there, and the more interesting that is, the more clicks you get. So it's really kind of a self-propelling development. And the amount of photography, I mean, it's still growing by the day. So more people take photos, more people discover photography, which is great, which is awesome. But it has a few side effects. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, there's too many people. You don't want to be elitist and say, well, you people go away. I want to enjoy the Positano all by myself. I mean, everybody has a right to visit. I think it's made worse a little bit by all the photography. But on the other hand, we promote photography, right? We want people to take pictures.
Oh, and I do want people to take pictures. And
so is social media making it worse?
Well, while I'm not putting geotags on my photos, I'm happy to tell people where that is, so people can do their own research. People can find their own locations. The one thing I don't want to do is one thing I recently saw in a book, and that was that each of the photos had a QR tag next to it, and if you pointed your camera at it, it opened a map right to that point.
No. Chris Marquardt, he's a great photographer, and he loves it when you take pictures. DiscoverTheTopFloor.com, and don't forget, if you want to join our photo assignment, what's the assignment this time?
It's Ring.
Ring. Take a picture illustrating the word or concept ring and post it to our Tech Guy group on Flickr, and we'll do a review before Chris leaves. Thank you, Chris. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Stop taking those Instagram shots. Start enjoying nature. We'll be back right after this. Seems like the wrong thing for the Tech Guy to say. But I agree 100% with you. It does sound a little bit...
I didn't want to make this a downer, but it is really a thing that's coming up over and over again
this
now.
Boyfriends of Instagram feed is hysterical.
This is hysterical, isn't it?
Partly, it's like the lengths people go to get a great shot, like the crazy things they do as much as anything else.
And while I was in Morocco, I've seen three or four of these couples, and it's a trend, and it's getting...
Get rid of them.
getting more dramatic.
I am not a fan, I have to say, of Instagram or Facebook at all. I've gotten off both.
I mean, it promotes a kind of a reality that's not there.
Yeah,
and
that's what I
don't
like.
It gives a lot of people the feeling that their lives aren't as interesting, right, and right, has a lot of implications.
Here's a good example. So they're trying to get a shot of a bathing beauty in a bikini floating in a serene pool. What you don't see is the guy holding up the reflector, the photographer hanging from a beam on a strap, the other guy holding her feet so she doesn't float away. It's crazy.
That's the way a professional photo shoot would work.
But everybody's doing it now.
But now everyone's kind of in that... In that,
ooh, I like this. This movement. Is for Halloween. Be an influencer for Halloween. It's an influencer Halloween costume set. Hi, I'm an influencer. Ay, 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 caramba.
Yes.
So when is your last day here?
I'll leave on the 1st of January.
Oh, okay.
So I'll be here on the 30th.
Great. I don't know if I'll be here on the 30th. No, we are. No. Or we are? We are not. So... your last show will be the 23rd. Are we here on the 23rd?
Yes.
All right, 23rd.
23rd. We are not here on the 30th, so your last show will be the 23rd in 2 weeks.
So in 2 weeks, we'll do the assignment and give a new assignment.
Very nice.
And then
that'll be a 2 month.
I'll be gone.
And I'm so jealous. Have a wonderful trip.
Oh,
you're going to have fun.
Pretty sure I will, yeah.
You need a vacation. See, you have worked it well. You're smart. You are able to take lengthy vacations.
Well, I have to every now and then.
At a price, I mean.
This is Monica's sabbatical. She brought up New Zealand, and nice. I was happy to.
So she gets a sabbatical. Yeah. Is she a professor? What does she do?
No, it's in her job, but she worked hard for it. So.
Oh, yeah. You have to work 7 years or something, right, to get a sabbatical.
Well, and then you have to, like, get a pay cut during that time and right. get a pay cut up front. And so,
is that
an
German,
interesting kind of setup.
German thing or just her company in particular?
I think just the company that's offering it, yeah.
I think in Australia they do this, like, as a nation.
There's really?
Yes. You earn your
time
sabbatical.
To move to Australia.
I know. I have too much of a work ethic. I would feel guilty. I like to, and I also would. I think I would get lonesome if I couldn't do my shows. I think this is my entire social interaction right now.
I'll be podcasting from there for sure.
See, right. This
Definitely.
Is my life.
Absolutely.
All right, Chris. Thanks. We'll talk again next week.
Talk to you next
See
week.
See ya. Bye-bye.
Take care.
He was born a traveling man. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number, website, techguylabs.com. Boy, I did not expect our photo guy, the digital photo guy, Chris Marquardt, to say, stop taking pictures. I guess he's not saying stop taking pictures. Just stop tagging your pictures with locations. I don't know. I mean, is it really... It does seem like, and this is really I think there are too many people. That's the fact. And it's something the world's going to have to deal with. There's the overpopulation. That's just the fact. It's also the case that tourism is on the rise, that some places where people have gone in the past, like Egypt and Turkey, are no longer desirable locations thanks to political unrest. And so those people are heading to more popular tourist spots like Hawaii for those of us on the West Coast and Europe for those of us on the East Coast. And those are getting overcrowded, but that's life. That's the way the world is. I do have to think social media has also played a negative influence in many ways. There are massive riots going on right now in France. And of course, France is known for political unrest and strikes. It's nothing new. Hundreds of arrests, deaths, disruptions all over the big cities in France, with these yellow jackets, and some are blaming Facebook for it because it is Facebook that is spreading the news, spreading the word, and kind of in a way becoming a way of inciting people to take to the streets and be violent. And we've seen this before. Remember the Arab Spring, where Twitter was praised, not blamed, but praised for giving activists in Arab nations like Egypt a voice and a chance to organize through Twitter. Except that, it can also be used, and we've seen it used this way, and we've seen Facebook used this way, to incite violence, to organize. And I guess one person's protest is another person's mob. So, maybe that's a difficult thing to solve, but it is a big problem right now. And a number of people are blaming Facebook for the unrest, the yellow jacket riots in France right now. Article in BuzzFeed News by Ryan Broderick. The yellow jacket riots in France are what happens when Facebook gets involved with local news. But it's not Facebook doing it, understand. Facebook's not doing anything except what they always do, which is encourage viewership. You know, algorithmically make Facebook more compelling. That's kind of their job. That's the job of engineers at Facebook, to tweak the news feed so that you will want to read it and spend more time on it. And that kind of facilitates virality, viral memes, viral videos. And there are some who say, well, the protests in France have been whipped up into a frenzy by the small Facebook pages with these memes and these videos. We saw riots in Myanmar, anti-Muslim riots facilitated by Facebook, Sri Lanka. We saw WhatsApp being used to create mob violence in India and Brazil. Do you blame the social media platforms, or do you blame people? That's the challenging thing. I mean, the social media platforms are in some ways are just reflecting what's out there. You can't really say Instagram made it impossible to go to Jackson's Hole, Wyoming, because so many people want to put their Instagram photos up. It's the people, isn't it? But there's something about these social networks that almost weaponizes our natural urge to share and turns it into a tool that's can be devastating. It's a fascinating question. It's a fascinating question. I don't know what the right answer is. It's one of the things I've been talking a lot about in the last few years. And it's one of the reasons I got off Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and Tumblr. I have accounts there, but they're deactivated. I didn't delete the accounts because I don't want somebody to pretend they're me. So the account's still there, but they're all deactivated. And I have to say, for myself, just personally, for myself, I feel a lot happier not going to visit those sites multiple times a day. The first step, and apparently a lot of kids are starting to do this, is to take the apps off your phone. Because when you see yourself looking at your phone 20 or 30 times, and both iOS and Android have ways for you to see how many times you open an app, how much time you spend on Facebook and Instagram. When you see that you're spending hours a day opening the phone hundreds of times a day just to look at Twitter, maybe it's time to stop. Maybe just try this. Take the Twitter app off your mobile device. Take the Facebook app off your mobile device. Instagram's a little harder. My wife says I'm crazy. She loves posting pictures on Instagram. She loves seeing pictures of her friends and family on Instagram. It's the way she keeps up. And frankly, it's the way I keep up sometimes, because she'll tell me, oh, yeah, he had a baby. They had a baby. I didn't know that. Well, she knew it from Instagram. So maybe I'm cheating a little bit, because I do get to keep up a little bit. My wife will tell me who got married, who's dating, who had a baby. But I think I don't want to know that much. It's not stuff we knew in the past, right? We're maybe a little too much of a global community now. Is that possible? I thought this was going to be huge. We talked last hour about how the internet democratized publishing, so you didn't have to have a record label or a book publisher anymore to tell your story, to sing your song. If you're a photographer, Instagram and Facebook are great platforms to share your art. And yet there's definitely a negative. There's a downside, isn't there? I feel, all I can say is for myself, I feel a lot better, a lot happier, because I disconnected a little bit. What? The tech guy disconnected. Yeah. I still love tech. I use it for other reasons. Still look at my phone. Play Pokemon Go. That gets me out walking around anyway, right? I don't claim to be a moral paragon or a thought leader in any way. I'm just observing. I'm as puzzled as everyone else is by the whole thing. What a world we live in. Debbie in Simi Valley, California. You're next. Hi, Debbie. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi there. I have a iMac computer that's a 2009 model.
Yeah.
And last year I took it into Apple because they said I needed a graphics card, and it was only good for 3 months, warranty. And now I think I have the same problem. I know it's almost 10 years old, so I'm just wondering if I should just get a new computer.
Well, the first thing to do is, even though it's out of warranty, bring it to Apple and be nice.
Well, actually, I called them, and they said because it's so old, they don't have the parts anymore.
That's what happens, of course, with any computer. Yeah. If you can afford it, because they're expensive, you would definitely benefit from getting a new iMac. They're much faster. The screens are much better. You can use the latest operating system. You'll have all the latest patches. And it'll be under warranty for a year. And if you get Apple Care, you can get up to 3 years. And a new computer is not going to... You're right that, you know, this may just be the beginning of the end.
Yeah, okay. That was my gut feeling, but I just wanted to ask you because my girlfriend told me to call you.
So. Hey, I love your girlfriend. So
yeah, I do too.
She's got good taste.
I'm sure I'll call you again in the future.
Please do. It's just a matter of money. You might look at a Mac Mini. They're less expensive. They start at $800 or $700, and of course you have to have your own screen, keyboard, and mouse. But they will do everything an iMac will do with separate components. That may save you money. It's a good choice. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, it's really money. But a 2009 computer is so old at this point.
Yeah, well, we had bought the 27-inch screen because my son was in college doing graphic arts.
Oh, it's a great. It was a great choice.
Well, I don't think, though, I need this big a screen.
Yeah.
Now
I would look at, so there's a couple of things to do. I mean, you can get an iMac, and then by the way, they have 0% financing right now at the Apple store, so you get one of the 5Ks or beautiful screens. But a Mac Mini is everything that is in an iMac, but then it doesn't include the screen, so you can get your choice of screen. And if you know what, that's nice. If you say maybe I don't need such a big screen, you get a smaller screen, and then you say no, I want a bigger screen, you can swap it. The iMac has two sizes, 21 and 27, and that's it.
Right.
So the Mac Mini, we connect the screen. You get a separate screen. You can get it from Apple, but you can get it anywhere. Dell, anybody makes them, so that means you can save some money. Get a keyboard, and you can get a – frankly, I don't think Apple's keyboards are all that. You can get a better keyboard, a better mouse. I use Microsoft mouses on all my Macs because I think they're better.
Okay.
And the Apple's Magic Mouse is a nightmare. So the mouse and keyboard that come with an iMac aren't that good.
Okay.
So think about, you know, go back to the Apple store and just talk about the Mac Mini. Spec it out. The one you want is probably more like $1,000, but that's still cheaper than an iMac.
Right.
And I think it's a pretty good alternative. I kind of wish now that I had a Mac Mini, because then you can have multiple monitors, lots of connectivity. It's more compact.
Yeah, well, you know, I have my desktop, but I also have my laptop, and I go from one to the other because I teach dance and I do notes.
Oh, that's
neat.
I
have music on one monitor, and I have my notes I type up on the other.
So here's another thought, then. If you have a laptop, you can get an external keyboard, mouse, and monitor for any Mac laptop and use it as a desktop.
External mouse and monitor, okay.
Yeah, so is it a Mac laptop or a Windows laptop?
Yeah, it's a Mac.
Okay. Is it more recent?
Oh, well, it's a 2012.
Okay.
2012.
You can easily with that, you know, it's got those ports on the side, connect a mouse, a keyboard, and it's even got a monitor port. You'll have to get a monitor that works with it. And you connect that. You leave that at home. When you get home, you plug those in, you close the Mac. This is one of the nice things Apple does. Even when the Mac's closed, if a monitor is connected, it says, oh, I'm still alive, and you use it as a desktop. Then when you hit the road, you just unplug those, you carry it off. And the nice thing is one computer. It all has the same stuff on it. You're already doing that. It sounds like you have an external monitor at the dance studio.
Well, yeah. I mean, I have an external monitor. Yeah.
So you're already doing that. You could do that at home, too. Then you don't need to buy a new computer. Just another monitor.
A monitor. Okay. External monitor and mouse.
Yeah,
okay.
Just like you're doing at the studio.
Well, the studio is in my home. I'm just doing this at home.
I see.
But I have my desktop and my laptop, and I, like I said, I listen to the song on the one, and then I put my notes on the other screen.
Oh, I see. But it's all on the laptop still. Or no, you're using the desktop and the laptop.
I'm using the desktop.
Ah, I see.
And I'm using my laptop for...
This is something worth trying. If you connect a big screen to your laptop, you can have the music playing on your laptop, have that laptop screen show the music player, and still have something completely different on that external monitor, but it's all on one computer.
Okay, and what would you recommend for a big screen? What brand?
Go to Dell. It'll be the least expensive. They're about $300, and you can get anything from, you know, a 21-inch monitor to, I would say 27 is the sweet spot, but they even have giant 30-inch and more. I have a 43-inch Dell monitor. It's too big. But it might be good for a studio. It'd be good for presentations. So, yeah, look at Dell's monitors. They're very good, and they're much less expensive than what Apple sells.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. You're going to need to check the connector on that laptop. It's probably, I'm guessing, Mini DisplayPort. So you're going to need to get an adapter to get the Dell to work with it. But that'll be an inexpensive little thing.
And I would get that right at Dell then.
Yeah. Yeah, you would want a Mini DisplayPort to HDMI adapter. Most of the Dell monitors now use HDMI. Amazon. Oh, okay. Actually, you can also look on Amazon. You don't even need to go to Dell. You can look at Amazon, too.
Okay.
Yeah, and just search for the adapter, which would be,
right.
I'm guessing, but you'll have to check on your laptop, Mini DisplayPort to HDMI.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what those 2012s are? Yeah. Port. I know that sounds complicated.
It does.
I have faith. I think dancing is complicated.
Well, thank you.
I can't do a foxtrot to save my life. What kind of dance do you teach?
I teach primarily tap.
Oh, wow. That's more complicated than anything.
And I teach two different places. I teach at the Senior Center in Simi Valley. And
fun.
Park and Rec in Thousand Oaks. And my seniors just had a performance Thursday afternoon and Friday night this week.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yes.
And they can do their shift ball shuffle, whatever that is.
Ball change, flat ball change, you got it.
They can do it all.
Yep.
What a great idea. And they get a little exercise. They have fun.
Yes.
You do a little slap, flap, shuffle.
Yep, you got it. Come on.
I want to do. No, I can't. It's like that to me is more complicated than figuring out what port you have on your laptop and connecting it to a monitor. That's complicated to you. Tap dance is insane to me.
Yeah, well, vice versa. For me, anything electronics, I'm just... In fact, my son had once told me, Mommy, you shouldn't have a computer. Bad.
That's anyway. Just because he doesn't want you to call him. You call me instead, okay?
Okay, sounds great.
Thank your girlfriend for me.
I will, and love you lots. Thanks.
Oh, thank you, too. Take care. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We got smartphones. We got smart watches. We got self-driving vehicles. We got augmented reality. 8888-ASK-LEO. I shouldn't mock this. I got a book by a guy I really like. Blake Harris wrote a book called Console Wars, which was fantastic, a history of game consoles. But I feel bad for Blake because he's obviously spent a long time writing a really great book. It's called The History of the Future. Good name, right? And then I saw the subject matter. Oculus, Facebook, and the revolution that swept virtual reality. Uh-oh. Uh-oh. It's a history of virtual reality. Now, I imagine towards the end it's going to have to say, there is a chapter called The Verdict. Maybe this isn't going to be the next big thing. Maybe not. Have you used... Now, see, it's funny because there's people who love these virtual reality headsets. They enter a new world. They play games. I have a friend who is a fanatic, so much so she and her husband both love virtual reality, so much so they moved to a new house. She had a virtual reality room in her old house, but she wanted two, one for each. And then they set up a third for the kids. That's a virtual reality devotee. I'm afraid I am not quite so optimistic about the future of virtual reality. But Blake, I'll read your book, Blake, The History of the Future. Even though I think maybe virtual reality was a little bit overhyped. No, that never happens in the tech industry. No. 8888-ASK-LEO, the phone number. On line two, Chuck, Beverly Hills, Michigan. Hello, Chuck.
Hello there.
Sorry to keep you on hold so long. Thanks for your patience.
Yeah. My question was, I'm 81 years old, still quite techy. That it seems to be a gene runs in our family. And I actually visited your show about 3 years ago, and we had a great time.
It was
a
Christmas
present for my wife.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Well, nice to see you again then.
And I have been getting interested in doing grandpa memories, you know, with my DSLR.
Nice.
And when I went to get memory sticks, SD cards, there is such a tremendous range for the same size. It can run anywhere from $10 to $40.
Right.
And I just wondered what the difference was.
So it is encoded on the front of that SD card. So when you go to, and I buy all my SD cards from Amazon, I tend to like SanDisk. They're a company that specializes in memory cards, and I think they make very good ones. Photographers will also often say, oh, no, you've got to get Lexar or one of the more premium-priced brands. So one of the differences is the brand name. And, you know, take it with a grain of salt. Brand names, there is a difference. I mean, you can get a memory card that will burn out faster or maybe less reliable. But in general, I think SanDisk is a cost-effective choice and gives you great results. The difference then among... So let's assume you're buying a single brand. In other words, I can't really tell you, is Lexar that much better? Is it twice as good? I don't know. Maybe. Some photographers say, oh, no, you got to get the professional Lexar cards. I don't know. What I look at, though, within a brand is speed. And those are all marked on the card. So there, and it is, I don't blame you for being confusing. It's extremely confusing. There is a number of designations for SD cards. The first designation you'll probably want to know about is SDXC. The XC cards are just expanded capacity. So in most cases, you're going to buy that. You don't want a 64 megabyte card. You want an extended capacity card that will go up to 2 terabytes. I wouldn't recommend a 2 terabyte photo card just because the temptation will be to put too much stuff on it. And then if it dies, you've lost more. I buy mostly 64 gigabyte cards, but those will be SDXC. The HC cards only went to 32 gigabytes. So that's the first thing you're going to notice. The next thing you're going to look at is the speed of the card, how fast it reads and writes. And you'll see something called UHS, which is ultra high speed. That's the ability to write faster and read faster. There's UHS 1, UHS 2, and UHS 3. And the speeds are, you know, greater as you move along. It's in general, you would say, well, why don't I get the fastest card? The fastest card means that you'll be ready to take another picture sooner. But you should also see what the capabilities of your camera are, because it turns out you can buy a card that's faster than your camera can write, and so there's no point in buying a faster card. So you first thing you want to do, and it might be require a little digging through the documentation or even reading reviews, is see what's the fastest card my camera will support.
Okay.
And, you know, if it can support UHS 3, or even there's even a faster standard, PCI Express, which no camera, to my knowledge, supports. But if it can support UHS 3, then it's nice because you can get back to shooting faster. Your camera has a little bit of a buffer, so it can take 5, 10, 30 pictures without writing to the card. But so you can even try this, you know, press and hold the button or turn it in burst mode and take pictures until they slow down. That whatever that number of pictures was is how much of a buffer it has. And then you'll notice the red light, the right light on the camera going and going and going as it writes that buffer to the card. The faster the card, the less time it'll spend writing, the faster you can get back to taking pictures. That's all that's about. If you shoot video with a camera, there may be also restrictions on the quality of video you can shoot depending on the speed of the card. And that's because video has such a high data rate. You know, you're recording so much data when you're shooting 4K mm-hmm. video, for instance, that it needs to have a fast enough card to keep up. So if you do shoot video, and I think that's for your grandkids and your family, that's a great thing to do, because I like to intersperse stills with short, not long, 4 or 5 second video clips. It makes for a fun slideshow because you get a little audio, a little video. It's a great scene setter. So that's also important. If you are going to use burst mode, get, you know, faster memory, but it will cost you more, you'll notice. Then there's also, there's other designations that you'll see on these cards. There'll be a little class circle with a 2, 4, 6, or 10. There might be a little, yeah, or a little U. The U is the UHS speed. And the S, or rather the 2, 4, 6, and 10 in a circle like a copyright sign, that's the speed class. You generally want class 10. Anything slower is really pretty old. You may see, I don't see this very often, but sometimes there's a V class for video shooting. You may see that designation on the thing as well. In my opinion, get a class 10 card with at least UHS, U2 or U3.
Okay, sure.
And if you can check your camera first, it may say doesn't write more than 90 megabytes a second, then you can get a slower card.
Yeah, it's a few years old. It's a Nikon D7000, but I've been very happy with it. I've been looking at some of the new ones, but I don't think I'll be jumping to a new one right now. But I'll talk to the fellows at the camera store and look at the camera information and see what it says.
I'm looking at a website that says the D7000 will use the new UHS cards. It can be, so you could get, a UHS 3 card and benefit from it. We'll be faster. With
okay, sir. That's what I'll do.
All right. Thanks for the call.
I appreciate, people know not to bother me on Saturday and Sunday afternoon.
Bless you, Chuck. That's awesome. And have fun taking pictures. It is literally the most fun I've ever had is just getting pictures of people. And what a great way to record your life, right? Make a little journal.
Very good, sir.
Have fun.
Thank you, and have a wonderful holiday.
You too. Happy holidays, Jack.
Bye-bye, sir.
Take care. I recently got, I had played with it for a long time, but I decided to get serious about a journaling app that's available on iOS and Android. Really great on an iPad. They even have a Macintosh version called Day One. And you can put pictures into it. You can write stuff. You can record audio into it. And as I get older, I regret now not having done this for years. I've tried a few of you have tried to keep a diary or keep a journal. Everybody says that's a good thing to do, and life is busy, and you know, you just don't get around to it. But I think it's kind of fun. I wish I had some diary entries from years gone by. I'd be curious. What was I thinking, for instance? What was I thinking? But I've decided to start trying it now, and it's really fun. And because we've come such a long way, it's not just writing. It's everything. It's multimedia. It even records your location and a stream. And if you just take pictures with your camera phone, it'll automatically keep a stream of all the pictures you take. So in a way, it's almost automated journaling. I really like that. That might be another thing to look at, Chuck, if you use an iPhone actually, they have an Android version now, an Android phone. Day One, DAYONE. Really cool. Really cool. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls right after this. There is a free Day One. I actually paid the $25, $26 for the year's subscription. For a little more. What's nice is it syncs across everything. I'll show it off on iOS today because I'm kind of excited about it. It's made it very easy. You know what got me started was doing those postcards, which is essentially a daily journal of my trip in Europe. And it got me in the habit of, at the end of the day, just kind of making some notes. Takes 10 minutes. And And I was really glad I had that because I kind of knew all the and so with day one, which I had used several, I had entries going back to 2012, but just really inconsistent. I put it back in all my stuff. And I think it's instead of doing social media, instead of kind of blah, I'm going to use day one. And day one, the original version had integration with WordPress, so I could have blog. I could kind of share stuff to the blog if I wanted to. Not everything; some stuff's private. But it's, they don't, haven't yet put that into day one version two, but I think there will. So I think it's a good solution. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo, the phone number. Jim, Ordway, Colorado. Hello, Jim. Leo Laporte.
Hello, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, I have a difficulty here.
Uh-oh, what's the matter?
I'm working in Windows 7, and I'm editing slides that I've scanned with my photo scanner.
Okay.
And I store them on a separate drive, an F drive, which is made by Toshiba.
Yep.
And this started occurring about a week ago. Windows recognizes the F drive if I go to grab a picture and open it in the Window Live photo gallery.
Okay.
And then if I click, double-click on Edit, Organize, or Share, it can't find the F drive. It says it doesn't exist.
Interesting.
Yet it is there, and it knows it's there because I can go to the picture.
But well, I got one caveat on that. Often photo apps, in order to speed up browsing the photos, don't in fact go out and look and load the photo in your catalog. They keep a thumbnail stored in the catalog. That's almost always the case. So it could be missing that photo and still show up in the catalog. Do you see what I'm saying? Because it keeps a cached thumbnail. That's almost certainly the way it works. I don't know. What program you said? Windows Photo Library?
The Live Photo Gallery.
Yeah. I don't remember if the Live Photo Gallery has an indicator. Most programs will if it doesn't have access to the original. But if you, you know, get info on that thumbnail or something and see, it might say, oh, no, I don't know where this is, or help me find this file.
Well, it loads the editor.
Yeah, I mean, it may be editing the thumbnail, though, instead of the original.
Well, it shows all the thumbnails, but over on the tree on the left,
yeah,
there's no F drive listed.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So let's hope your F drive's still there. Tell me about the F drive. Was it something that came with your laptop? Or
No. It's outside. I use it as a backup drive.
Okay, so it's a USB drive.
Yes, it's a USB drive. And Windows recognizes it because I can go to the, you know, double-click on the folders.
You can open it up.
Yeah, I can open it up, and I can open up the picture.
Ah, good. Well, that's good news.
Let me edit it.
So I'm going to give you one quick assignment. Make a backup. Is that the only place those pictures live?
Yes.
Very important, because I don't want your next call to be, now the F drive's not working, where are my pictures? So before you do much else, I would copy those, either buy another USB drive or find somewhere to copy, but copy those photos just so you don't lose them, okay? One copy of anything is really dangerous. It means that if that drive fails, and drives fail, and, you know, it hasn't failed, I think I can understand what's going on, and I'll help you with that. But I do think really important, if it's acting flaky in any way, that's a sign from heaven. You need to make a backup. And by the way, if the USB drive dies, then that backup's not a backup anymore. That's the original. You need to make a backup of the backup.
Right.
You need two copies. I'd say three copies of everything that counts, that's important. Maybe those pictures aren't important. No big deal then.
They're important.
I sense they might be, yeah.
That drive has 211 gig on it.
Yeah, so, you know, you might want to make a trip to your local big box store and buy a big hard drive. You can get a terabyte hard drive for under $100 right now. Plug it in and copy everything over to it. Then, having done that, the fact that you can open up and see it, that's very good. That means those photos are there. It means somehow the live gallery has lost track of where the photos live, or it's just confused. Partly that may be because it's a USB drive which comes and goes. Another thing you might try is just see if you can see that drive on any other. I don't know if you have another computer with a USB port, but see if you can see that drive anywhere else. Make sure it's there. I'm not sure what's gone on. Your live gallery should give you more information when you get info on any individual photo. What you want to see it say is F, you know, where is this, you know, sometimes they say open photo in original folder or open and closing folder, or sometimes it'll say the path, which is F colon, you know, slash, you know, volume slab, whatever that thing is. If it shows that and you can go to that, well, then that means it's seeing it. But it sounds to me like it's confused, like it's not sure. So job one, anytime you got something valuable, only one copy, make a backup. Scooter X is telling us Office Max has an ad for a 2 terabyte Western USB My Passport drive. 2 terabytes, 10 times more than your photo collection, $70. I'm not crazy about the giant drives, the 4 terabyte drives. The bigger the drive gets, the more likely you're going to have problems with it. Get a single terabyte. That's fine. It's only 211 gigabytes. You can back that up to the cows come home. So make a backup. Then you start fiddling with it, like unplug it, replug it in. You say you can see it. You can open folders. That's good. That means the drive's working. It means there's a disconnect. The Windows Live Gallery somehow has lost track of where that photo is. And that should be somewhere indicated in the thumbnail on the photo. Most programs will say something like, oh, we can relink that file or show me where that file really is. And often doing one of them will find the rest of them. Something like that's going on. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go. 8888 Ask Leo. Gordon's on the line from Long Island. Hello, Gordon.
Hello, Leo. How are you this fine day?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, thank you, my friend.
We flew into JFK last week and unusually took a flight path over Manhattan. It was such a beautiful sight to see Manhattan and then Long Island, and the sky was perfectly clear. The lights were beautiful. It was a wonderful flight. I've not usually seen that flight path, so it was really nice. Like, you could see Central Park. That was fun. Anyway, I just came from Long Island.
Well, I agree with you. I've flown back into LaGuardia some nights where you just go right along the skyline of New York. Yeah. And I don't think there's a nicer view from an airplane
Just beautiful. What can I do for you?
Well, Leo, recently on local newscasts here, they ran some stories concerning routers. And they're saying pretty much that you need to update your firmware, which we all know. But they also said that after 3 years or so, routers may become outdated and less secure. With that in mind, I have an Asus AC3200, one of those 6-inch.
I love that router. I have it, too. We got it sitting in the studio over there right now.
It's a great router. It performs wonderfully. I don't know about replacing it or not, but they've just recently had a sale.
So it's funny when you see these stories on local news, and you know that the anchor's reading this and has no idea what they're talking about. A lot of times they're reading from an electronic press kit provided by, router manufacturers, maybe the Router Manufacturing Association. It's a strange recommendation. You'll hear me talk about this a little bit. It is an issue these days. Routers are getting hacked. Just read a story about a router company called MikroTik. I know you don't have a MikroTik, but that as many as 400,000 of their routers have been compromised with, get this, Bitcoin mining software. So some wise guy figured out a flaw in the MikroTik routers, which haven't been updated. He took advantage of that to spread some software that makes him money, each and every router, just doing a little bit of work trying to generate Bitcoins for this cat. That's wild. Now, a good router company, and ASUS is one, will patch their routers regularly. Most more modern routers than yours, most of the latest routers, have automatic updating. And the next time you buy a router, for sure, that is what you should look for. Because otherwise, it's a pain. You got to remember, I haven't updated the router in a few months. I probably should get an update. And even the new Asus routers will do that automatically. But your 3200 is perfectly fine. Asus based their router firmware on an open source router platform called DDWRT, which is excellent and gets updated regularly. Asus, in my experience, continually updates their routers. You just got to set a little calendar reminder every few weeks to update it.
Well, that sounds good. But recently they had a sale in one of our big box stores here offering a Netgear Orbi system.
Ooh.
And that seemed to have a larger area of coverage.
Yes.
Than does the AC3200.
Yeah.
And since we enjoy using our backyard in the summertime, I've frequently had problems getting the signal, the Wi-Fi signal, to pass all the way to the backyard.
Yeah. You're going to love the Orbi. If you're getting a good deal on it, I would take a look at it. The Orbi is one of these new mesh routers. One of the things I just mentioned, the automatic updates happens with the Orbis. That's nice. They automatically will get fixed if there are problems. Netgear promises for some number of years to keep those up to date. The Orbi, as a mesh system, comes with a base unit, which connects to your cable modem or your DSL modem, and a satellite unit. But you can buy additional units. And Orbi is the only one I know of that has an outdoor unit. So you'd set up your base station, you'd put the satellite somewhere distant in your house to give you coverage around the house, and then if you find you're still not getting good coverage out in the patio, you get one of those outdoor units this summer, and you'd really be great.
Well, this comes with two satellite units in addition to the base unit.
That's great. That's more than you probably need. How many square feet are you trying to cover?
Well, it says that it's capable of doing 7,500 square feet. I certainly have less than that to cover.
Is that how big your house is? Typically, it's about 1,500 square feet per unit.
Right.
The nice thing about the Orbi, it's really powerful and very fast. I actually set a neighbor up. Our next-door neighbor was having trouble with his Wi-Fi. Same kind of problem. It just wouldn't reach all the corners. Set up an Orbi for him. He's been very happy with it. They're really, really, I think, nicely made. I like the regular updates. They don't have all the features of other mesh systems, but they are, I would say the Orbi is probably the fastest, and I love it that they offer an outdoor unit. That might be the real solution for you.
Could you add the outdoor unit as an add-on after you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep.
And does the Orbi update, like you said, the newer routers do?
You bet. You bet. It's a very good router. It actually has fewer features than your Asus. Asus has some really interesting quality of service features and things like that and better monitoring. But if you don't use those features, then you won't miss them.
Well, I understood when I got the Asus that it had a special way of downloading packets of data so that you would have less buffering on TV or other audio.
Yeah, they all say that. It's quality of service that you want, which says, hey, this guy's watching TV. Make sure he gets prioritized packets because because his wife in the living room is just looking at the web and getting emails. She can get packets with less priority. That's a nice feature. That's called QoS, or quality of service. The Asus does have it. The theory with all mesh routers is that they will do it automatically. And frankly, that's what you want. You want to kind of automatically sense what needs better bandwidth. I don't know if the Orbi does that. It's at least when I tested them, they weren't exactly a mesh router. They were kind of a quasi-mesh router. Although I suspect over the years, I haven't tested it in about a year and a half, Netgear has probably improved the technology. It always was the fastest router out there, and a lot of people are very happy with the Orbi. I think it's a great choice. If you can get a good deal on it, you probably don't need three units, but what the heck?
I just figured the larger area says we cover, the more chance I have of reaching that
exactly.
Patio.
It won't hurt to have more units.
Right.
Your neighbors may not like you because they'll be seeing your Wi-Fi better than they see their own.
Well, hopefully they won't be able to jump on board.
Orbi has added Disney's Circle. If you have kids or grandkids coming over and you want to control what stuff they can do online, you can, for an additional fee, you can use Disney's Circle on Netgear. So that's nice. That's a new thing that they've added. But absolutely, Orbi would be an improvement. I don't know if you need it, but if you're saying you have Wi-Fi problems, a mesh router will absolutely do better. And they're tri-band. They do 2.5 gigahertz and 1 2.4 gigahertz band. That is a big deal. That's very helpful. There's lots of other reasons mesh routers are better. I'm very happy with it, to be honest. I thought it was a very good product.
So basically, it would be a good product to change over to. However, you don't think that the Asus is outdated at this point in time?
No, I do not. It's just the only thing about the Asus, you're going to have to keep updating it. And if you do want to extend it by adding an extender, I think you'd be better off going to the Orbi.
How about customer service between the two? I know that Asus has provided exceptionally.
I think they're very good. I haven't tested Netgear's customer service, but I would expect them to be good. They're a good company. That's a good question. I should really make a point of testing customer service. I rarely call anybody. Because I'm the tech guy, man. but I don't have any experience with Netgears. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We will be going home. Last segment of the day, last segment of the weekend. But don't worry, I'll be back next week. And, of course, during the week, if you have any questions, you can just go to our website, which is free. There's no sign-up. There's no nothing. Just go to techguylabs.com, and you'll find show notes from all 1,548 shows. Audio and video for most of them, too, including this one. So you can even answer questions yourself. If you see something, you say, hey, you know, I got a better idea. Or I had that Orbi router. And, you know, if you have experience with Netgear's tech support, go on in there. Leave a comment. It's always valued. We really appreciate it. Line 2, Stephen, San Antonio, Texas. Hello, Stephen.
Good afternoon. So, you know, I'm a California transplant.
All right. How do you like San Antonio?
I love it.
Beautiful area.
Rain.
Yep.
Anyway, my computer in the lower right-hand corner keeps telling me I need to activate Windows.
Uh-oh.
I go in and I say, okay, here's my PIN number. So I put the product number in. It's okay. Next thing, I turn my back, come back. Because you need to activate Windows.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What version of Windows are you on?
10.
10, you shouldn't need to enter anything. The advantage of 10 is once a computer, this is by design from Microsoft, obviously it's not working, but once a computer has been authorized to use Windows 10, it never needs to be authorized again. Microsoft has a database of all the computers allowed to run Windows 10, and that database includes information about your video card, your networking card, your hard drive, motherboard, all of that stuff. They've got some sort of magic system for combining all that into a single number. If that number hasn't changed, if you haven't changed any hardware dramatically, they figure that's the machine and you're authorized. The fact that you're not authorized makes me think you were never authorized. There is no serial number to enter for Windows 10 unless you're buying a copy. And upgrading it that way. Most people have either got Windows 10 with a computer, which means it's authorized, or upgraded from Windows 7 and 8 when that upgrade was offered for free. And in all those cases, you shouldn't have or need a serial number. If you bought a shrink wrap copy somewhere, you would. Where did you? Is this computer start with Windows 10 or has it been upgraded?
No, it's been upgraded from 7. I didn't have this problem until I moved to Texas.
And you upgraded it using the free upgrade opportunity?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, there was an issue with the Windows activation server about 3 weeks ago where a lot of legitimate copies of Windows were being dinged as illegitimate. But I think that's been solved. I think the what's in order at this point is a call to Microsoft because that's not how it's supposed to happen.
Yeah, because I troubleshoot it, and it says, okay, this copy of Windows has been activated, but
yeah.
It still comes back.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you, like I said, it didn't start happening until after I moved from Texas, and that was in October.
I don't think that's one of the things they keep track of, but maybe it is. So what's happening, and it happens with all versions of Windows, it's phoning home. It's phoning the activation servers periodically and saying, hey, I'm a legit copy, right? And the activation server says, yeah. And it says, okay. But for some reason, it's responding no. And you're getting that pop-up. I think what you need to do is call Microsoft, explain the situation so that they can go into their database and fix it. It may be. I don't think they keep track of location, but maybe they do. You know, all of this is screwy anti-piracy stuff. It's very annoying because you have a legitimate copy. There's not a, you know, that's not a question. And presumably Microsoft would be intelligent enough to say, oh, yeah, we can fix this. I hate to send you there because that means hours wasted. But I don't know if maybe somebody listening knows or has seen this happen. I haven't. It's not supposed to happen. Once activated, always activated. That's the theory. And I don't think moving should affect it. As I said, they keep track of what your machine is by creating a what they call a hash, a magical number out of. And they've never told us exactly what. A reasonable guess would be things like the serial number of your motherboard, the MAC address of your networking devices, the size of your hard drives, things that make your machine unique. And in theory, everybody would have a unique hash. If that hash is in the database of activated Windows 10 machines, you'd never should see that message ever. So maybe they need to you may call them up and say, hey, can you bang on the activation server? Just hit it with your hand. Needs a little percussive maintenance. Something's going on. Henry, Prescott Valley, Arizona. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Henry.
How you doing, Leo?
Couldn't be better. How are you?
Me too.
Good. What can I do for you?
If I were any better, I'd be twins.
Double. Two Henrys. Actually, my son's named Henry. I love that name, so welcome.
So do I.
Yeah. What can I do for you, Henry?
You took a call from my good buddy Rob about a month ago, I guess.
Uh-huh.
He's the one that lost the Martin guitar at the Kingston.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love Rob. I've talked to him many times before. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He accompanied me on three songs, actually, at this year's Americana Fantasy Camp.
Oh, fun. What do you play?
One with the Salty Dogs and two with the Elderly Brothers.
The Elderly Brothers. Wake up, little Susie. Uh-oh.
There you go.
Yeah.
What? I play Tim.
Are you Phil or Don?
Either one.
The Elder. I love that. You play, what'd you say, tenor?
Tenor guitar, four string.
Oh, interesting. I've never seen a tenor guitar.
Oh, yeah. They were popular back in the 20s and 30s.
Oh, how interesting. Oh, that's that tink, tink, tink sound you hear on some of those older songs.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, what can I do for you today?
I heard a rumor that Apple is not going to upgrade the AirBuds until about 2020. Do you know if there's any truth to that?
Yeah, the problem with Apple rumors is no one knows. Rumors spread. Apple doesn't confirm. Apple never pre-announces. This rumor came from a guy who's famous for, you know, his rumors, his prognostications. He's a Chinese, writes for a Chinese data analyst, and he is very connected with the supply chain. So his information comes from manufacturers who are making these devices. So in effect, what he's telling his subscribers, because, you know, they're investors mostly, is, well, we don't see anybody making new AirPods this year. However, I have heard rumors that Apple will announce a new AirPod of some kind this year, by which I mean 2019, probably with a wireless charging case, because Apple still thinks it's going to put out a wireless charging mat that will charge AirPods. They announced it more than a year ago, AirPods, iPhones, and Apple Watches all at once. And this power mat, though, is way delayed. But in order to do that wireless charging of AirPods, you'd have to have some sort of AirPod container that did wireless charging. So it's pretty certain, I think, that they will announce at least that. But he says, Ming-Chi Kuo is the guy, he says that there won't be a completely redesigned AirPod for another year. I think that's reasonable, but no one really knows. Even Ming-Chi Kuo has been wrong. So, you know, it's hard to say. Do you have AirPods today?
Yeah, I have. I do have them, and
they're nice.
I have a little trouble with them once in a while, and I found that they seem to be susceptible to dust, and I've kind of cured that problem.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, AirPods are easy to lose. They're expensive. The audio quality is not perfect. And they are heir to all the troubles that Bluetooth devices are heir to, including dropout. I've been on AirPod connections with my smartphone more than once on my iPhone where I've just lost the connection. The iPhone's taken it back, and that's very frustrating when you're talking and nobody can hear you. But that's just the nature of Bluetooth, I think. Apple probably won't redesign them this year, but no one knows. That's the right answer. Thanks to Big Pee-wee, Damien, for playing our great music today. Kim Schaffer, our phone angel, for answering your calls. Most of all, thanks to you for joining me. I'll be here next week. I hope you will, too. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great geek week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.